Hey guys, welcome back to UAP Study. So we are in full swing. I believe this is the second episode that we are releasing since the relaunch, of course. And how you doing, Michael?
I'm doing fantastic.
Yeah.
The weather has finally broke in Charleston, South Carolina. So I get to wear a hoodie for the first time without just sweating straight through it.
Yeah, fall's my favorite season by far. I'm starting to get my voice back from coughing up a lung for the last week. It's been crazy. I've been up till like 3 o'clock in the morning, just getting everything prepped for the relaunch, which is awesome. But today, guys, we are honored to have Matthew Roberts join us on the podcast today. As you can tell, he's a man that is well-read. He's got lots of books behind him. If you don't see this on the podcast, know that it's there if you're listening to it instead of watching it. Matthew Roberts is the author of Initiated. It's basically, the book covers so many subjects: UAPs, dreams, depression, delusion, shadow people, psychosis, sleep paralysis, and so much more. Matthew was actually a former U.S. Navy cryptologist, which we're going to ask him what that is, and also a former Office of Naval Intelligence Analysis. So this guy is a smart cookie. They don't let people, just anybody, do this kind of work. And he's an experiencer as well. And we actually discovered him while we were doing the Patreon watch party for Netflix. And one of the things he said at the end, which we are going to repeat, was just beautifully said. And I had to reach out to him right away and say, hey, can you come on UAP Studies podcast and explain to us, you know, your experience, what's going on in the past, what's going on now? So Matthew, thank you so much for joining us today, man.
Yeah, guys. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
So basically, let's just get to know you. I want to know about your past, who you are, and how you got involved with the Navy.
So I joined the Navy kind of late. I was 25 when I joined, and I joined as a cryptologist. And cryptology is just the study of encryption. So like ones and zeros, how computers talk to each other. And it's very kind of a pattern oriented profession. I'm trained in like kind of pattern recognition type thing. So that's what I did for 16 years in the Navy. And then of course I did lots of tours on ships. I did a tour on the Theodore Roosevelt, obviously, in 2015 with the gimbal event. You know, and after that, I transferred to the Office of Naval Intelligence, where I was an analyst for 3 years. And, you know, while I was there, that's when the events happened to me that I document in Initiated, which is my book.
Those events start with the gimbal or the GoFest. Which one is it?
So both of those videos were from this event, right? And this event was a several days long event. It wasn't just a singular jet took off and saw one craft. You know, it went on for three or four days ish, I think. So but then, you know, I'll tell you too, after we deployed and we were in the Gulf, they came back. So we saw them again, which, I mean, is odd, you know.
It's odd, but were the ships at this point nuclear powered?
Yeah, the Theodore Roosevelt is a nuclear powered submarine, aircraft carrier. Sorry,
right? Because I heard that the there was an increase in sightings the minute that they started switching their ships over to nuclear powered. It seems like these sightings became a lot more frequent.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, that's what they say. I'm not so sure about that, you know, because I feel like, you know, when I started having all these experiences, I started researching this stuff, right? And I feel like I came up with articles from, you know, the 1800s of sailors out on the water seeing things, meteors that were going into and coming out of water.
They would call it meteors, yeah.
Right, and meteors, of course, don't do that. But, you know, so they were, I mean, people have always seen things on the ocean, I feel like.
So as I have heard you say or gathered from other interviews that you've done, the the gimbal event and the GoFest event and other events that haven't been released through, you know, the New York Times videos or whatever, these things happen while you're out on the ship. And you, of all the people that I've heard talk about them, seem to have experienced it really personally and emotionally, or at least you've been able to talk about the personal and emotional dimensions of that experience a lot more than other people have. I mean, you said that you initially felt like they were there for you or something, or at least you felt that way if you didn't think that. Can you talk a little bit about like the emotional dimensions of this and like the difference between whether you actually believed the things that you were feeling, or whether feelings just came upon you, and how that all sort of went into your interpretation of what had gone on?
Yeah, I mean, during the gimbal event, obviously I discovered that this was going on. A buddy of mine came into the skiff where I work. He worked more closely with the pilots in the air wing, and he was like, "You're not going to believe this." He's like, "Check this out." You know, and so he told me where to go. I pulled it up on my computer that was in front of me in the skiff, and we watched, you know, the gimbal and go fast videos. There were more, but that was the first time I saw the gimbal video. And I found that I had just this kind of emotional response to it all that others around me didn't seem to be having. Not that it was visible or anyone could tell that I was kind of emotionally shaken by sure. this, but it was something that I noticed within myself, you know, and I just kind of didn't really want to talk about it, but I watched this footage obsessively, right? Like,
did
I watched
you feel
it.
Fear, or what was the flavor of the emotions at first?
You know, the flavor of the emotions was just, I don't know, I guess like kind of apprehension. I felt a little apprehensive about the whole thing. I felt like, and I got this intense feeling that they were there for me, and that, and that someone was going to find that out. And that would be very bad for me. You know,
it's interesting. Yeah.
And I, you know, I got this feeling and I thought, God, that is just such nonsense.
Yeah. You know? You would rationalize it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I was like that. What is that? I was like, I just kind of like put it out of my head and forgot about it, because I thought it was just, it's whatever that was, it's nonsense. Right.
I think that's important for people to know too, is that there's a difference between you immediately believing that these things are there for you, which might be interpreted maybe validly as a kind of delusion or paranoia, and you feeling something and then pushing it out and knowing that this is not a normal pattern of thought for me. Was there anything about the videos or the experiences that you could point to and explain why you felt that sort of personal, ominous connection to it? Or is it just something that was there for no other apparent reason?
You know, there was nothing I could point to that I thought would explain that, the fact that I felt that way, you know? And so at the time, right, I didn't understand that. And I was like, this is just nonsensical. I shouldn't be thinking this. I shouldn't be feeling this. You know, let's get back to the logic of the world and forget about that, whatever that is, you know, but it was there nonetheless. You know, and
that's gotta be weird, because I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. You're a professional, you know, right, on board. You gotta stay professional and try to be biased on this, but there's an emotional reaction to this. Did you see the color videos at all, or did you just see the black and white, what we're seeing as a public?
Yeah, the only thing I saw was the same clips that everybody has seen of those two particular videos.
Some people say that there are better versions of it, and they're sort of incredulous that those are the versions that have been released to us. Do you think that that's true?
No, I don't. I don't have them in a side-by-side comparison, but I don't think, from what I remember of seeing these videos in 2015, it wasn't like a higher resolution image than what everyone else is seeing right now. So I think that That is, sorry about that. My phone's going off.
Oh, no worries. No worries.
Let me just turn it off. I thought I turned off the ringer.
We have an editor. We can just cut this out.
No, I like the authenticity yeah. of it all, right?
We just said that to make you feel better, but we won't actually get to the work.
I have a question for you, Matthew. So were you a believer, or I hate the word believer because it sounds like it's religion, but were you looking into this phenomenon before this happened, or did this initiate it for you?
No, this really kind of initiated it for me because this wasn't a topic that I thought about at all.
Right.
In life. You know, in fact, there's that show Ancient Aliens. When that would come on TV, I would change the channel. You know, I'm just like, tinfoil hats, these guys, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
As you should.
All right.
After season eight, they crashed.
In my opinion, at least, as you should.
Right. And so like whenever I saw a show about, you know, aliens or like alien encounters, I would just kind of roll my eyes and change the channel. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something I looked at or took seriously or even thought about. But then, you know, when this stuff happened on the ship, I thought to myself, wow, this stuff maybe is real, but I don't know to what extent. You know, I don't know what the truth is out there. And I thought, well, if there is somebody studying this within government, it's obviously a program that I'm not read into, so I'm never going to know anyway. Right. So I just kind of, you know, after the incidents and after the deployment, we came back, I kind of just put it away.
So why didn't you immediately just adopt some sort of like prosaic explanation for it? Like people like Mick West will offer for the Gimbal video an explanation that there's some lensing going on, some sort of weird photographic artifact going on. Why couldn't you just swallow that? I mean, I'm sure you went down some of those explanatory trails before you landed on the conclusion that there's something really strange going on here.
Right. Well, that's the thing, is that a lot of these people like Mick West and a lot of other people that try to come up with prosaic explanations of it, they don't really understand what happens on the ship during an event like this, right? If you have an unidentified up in the air, that's a huge deal. That is huge, especially if it's not emitting its IFF like it's supposed to in accordance with international law to identify itself. You know, and being in the military on a ship, the question in a post 9/11 world immediately becomes, is this an airliner that has been hijacked? Right. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly it becomes a very serious situation. Right. So these people like Mick West that think that, oh, we just, you know, Skipper turned out the lights and we all went to bed and forgot about it. And we didn't bother to really look in too much detail at this is just ludicrous. Right. So I want everyone to fully understand that this is something that was investigated, right? We knew it was unknown, because we saw it, we had video, and it wasn't explainable. It was totally anomalous.
Right? There were multiple independent sensors that were looking at this thing. Yeah. So it couldn't have just been one camera malfunctioning or something, or one system malfunctioning.
Right. And I've heard this explanation that, oh, it's an F-18, you know, that maybe its IFF was broken or whatever, but mm-hmm. was it broken for 3 days, you know, right. And in three separate flights?
What are the odds, right? Yeah.
Right. That doesn't add up. Right. And it is a huge deal that, you know, with $1 billion aircraft or carrier on the line, or $10 billion, however much it costs, you need to know what is around you at all times. And if you don't, you're asking for trouble, right? So everything gets identified. And then if something is coming into your airspace, you know, you get on the horn on the international hailing frequency and you say, hey, this is US warship, whatever, you know, vector away from us because this is restricted airspace, right?
Right.
So it's taken very seriously. We'll launch jets. We'll escort that aircraft away from us. It's just such a big deal.
And there's a process.
People, right. Yeah. There's a whole SOP on this that we follow. So for people like Mick West to just come up with these simple, nonchalant explanations, it's nonsense.
Seagulls. Yeah. Seagulls. Yeah. Well, actually, and we're going to get to your story after you came back. But just as an insider, what was it like on the Theodore Roosevelt and like mood wise with the crew? Like, were people talking about this? Was this something that freaked people out? Because, you know, the United States right now is the most powerful nation in the world and has a lot of technology. And when you face something that goes from 80,000 feet to 5 feet above the water in a split of a second, you cannot fight that. Right. Mm-hmm. That is a ship and it goes into the water. It does whatever it wants. We don't have like your aircraft carrier will, send out planes to go fighting, but it can't follow the thing into the water. Now you need a separate team to go. It's fascinating. But what was it like for the crew and the staff aboard the ships at the time that this was occurring?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to the higher chain of command because obviously I wasn't privy to what, was going on with the Admiral right. and everyone else like that. But I can tell you the people that I immediately worked with, they seemed very uninterested in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was very odd to me because I had like kind of this emotional reaction to it. And I knew that. And so I was I would pull up the footage whenever I had, a free half
coffee
hour
break.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'd watch it and some of my guys would come in the shop, and walk past me and they're like, are you watching that again? Like, what are you doing? And I was like, how do you not think this is the most amazing thing you've ever seen?
Yeah.
And they just kind of roll their eyes and head towards the back, they just were very uninterested in it.
Do you think it's because they believe some prosaic explanation?
I don't know. We never really had that discussion. But I mean, as we watched the footage for the first time, all of us kind of gathered and watched it. I think we all kind of knew what this was, but nobody really said that. it was just very strange, I think that, you had people on the one hand that were very uninterested in it. And then you had people like me who were kind of more intensely interested in it. I was intrigued, but I wanted to keep it at a distance. I don't know if that makes sense. I was both drawn in and repulsed at the same time.
Yeah, that's a weird state to be in for sure.
Yeah.
Speaking with Kevin Day, Sean Cahill, Ryan Graves and Omar Lara, they were all serving in the Navy and they've all been affected by these events and they've all taken something home. And people undermine that when you have a sighting, it's not detached from emotions. There are somehow emotions involved. Yeah. And people go, when you see somebody go from zero to hero, let's just put it that way, from not believing to UAPs to, oh my God, wake the F up, people, there's something here. There's a major event. There has to be a major event. We talk about this. It's not only subjectively, but objectively. They both merge together. There's a synchronicity between them both, and it changes your life, your perspective on things. Most people don't experience that, right? They don't pay attention. They don't care. It has nothing to do with their bills or going to work. But they don't understand how deep of an impact this whole phenomenon has. It affects every man, woman, and child on this planet. Mm-hmm. Because there's no military in the world that could come and save your butt if these things decide to come out middle of the night to take you. Nothing. Can't call the cops. Military and government aren't going to do anything. If anything, they tell you to be quiet, right? Mm-hmm. So it is a major issue because not only are we the civilians experiencing it, but the people in the military experiencing it. And people forget the people in the military are our kids, right? They're our brothers and sisters. They go to serve their country and they come back. They're like, something's going on, right? Our country's up to something. And now we're having whistleblowers come out. Supposedly 30 of them are lined up to testify. Now, I'm not a big fan of Sean Kirkpatrick. I think he's been asleep at the wheel ever since he's been given a job. He's now saying comments like, oh, I think there's something there now because we had 30 witnesses. Like, oh, it takes 30 witnesses that worked in government programs for you to go, maybe there's something. Oh, man, it aggravates me. But it is what it is. Let's go with the process. You come back from your service and you come back home. What does this do to your life?
Yeah, so I mean, you're talking about after the deployment when I got back.
Yes.
So, you know, after that, I had just kind of put this in the back of my head. You know, I thought, I honestly believed that if the, like I said, this was some kind of program, I'm not read into the study of it. I'm never going to see that footage again. I was resigned to that, right? And so I decided that I was not going to really look into this because I didn't know where to start. You know, being an analyst, you know, you take, you know, truths that you come across or credible things that you come across, and then you drill down on that to find some kind of ground truth as to what's happening, right? Sources. You need sources to drill down on. And I didn't have that, right? I didn't know who was involved with this. So I put it away. And I tried not to think about it too much, although I did think about it a lot. It would just occur to me just like almost every day, like
it pops
that,
up.
That footage, you know? But then I'm just push it out of my mind. I'll never know. And that was it. So that was kind of what I did with it until, you know, I transferred to ONI.
And what happens then? I know I heard in another interview you talk about sort of a series of synchronicities that led you to start maybe not just reading, but reading in particular directions on this. There's a car with a MUFON sticker on it, I think, that played some role in this. And I would really like to find that person because there can't be that many MUFON Maryland hatchbacks driving around. But can you tell us, like, where you went? So you get transferred to ONI, and at some point you start looking into this and saying, well, maybe I need to, I mean, you're an intelligence analyst, so you start looking for sources of information. What sources did you glom on to, and where did they take your thinking?
Well, so the sources I kind of latched on to were the same that were available to everyone else. I my brother texted me one day after work and said, hey, the government's got a UFO program, you know, and he says it's in the New York Times and there's footage, you know, in this text message he sent me. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, I secretly kind of did not want to have this conversation with him. He knew I worked at the Office of Naval Intelligence. So, I mean, obviously that's why he was asking me about it.
He's like, hint, hint. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And, but I, you know,
not
I
because he knew that you'd had this experience in the Roosevelt, but because he knew that you had these military connections. That's why he texted you about this.
Yeah. I mean, he thought that if anybody would know, that he knew personally, it would be me. Right. So he reached out and he was like, hey, you know, take a look at this. And so I looked at it, and then that was the first time I saw the gimbal footage again outside of the skiff. And I was just blown away by that because, you know, my whole job, it's all about secrets and keeping them. And so, you know, having seen something in a skiff and then now here I am watching it on my cell phone, that in my world, that just did not, that it was like a punch in the face. I was like, what is happening here? That shouldn't be.
It was
happening.
Also validating because you described being in the skiff, which is like the secure information room or whatever. You talk about being in there and sort of obsessively watching this video and everybody else being like, oh, why are you looking at that? And then you leave. And then one day, boom, the very thing that you were watching on the laptop in the skiff obsessively is now on the front page of the New York Times.
Yeah, it's gotta be weird.
Yeah. Yeah. It
Does that
was,
feel like
it
validation. Was...
not really validation, because I knew, you know, I knew back then when I saw it that it was something, right? So it was like, oh my God, this is all coming out in the public now. And I and my brother, of course, like, I immediately after I saw the footage and read the article, like, he's calling me, right? And I was like, oh God, I let it ring a couple of times because I just didn't want to talk about this.
Yeah.
And I was like, what am I going to tell him? You know? So anyway, he's on the phone with me. He's like, you know, do you know anything about this? And I kind of like gulped, and I was like, well, you know, it's all out there in the New York Times. I was like, yeah, you know, this was when I was on the Theodore Roosevelt, and, you know, the Air Wing collected this footage while I was there. I've seen it before. You know what I mean? And so for him, that was like kind of a gut punch, because he didn't think this stuff was real either, really. But then when he saw it in the New York Times, he's like, maybe. But then to hear me say, oh, well, I was there, it was like, okay, now this is real, you know? So
yeah, you're not prone to lying. I mean, you're part of the Office of Naval Intelligence, for crying out loud, as analysis. If you were to tell me, yeah, you think they're here, I would believe you. As far as I'm concerned, they don't give these positions to somebody who's mentally unstable, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would be the same. I'd be like, okie dokie, message received for sure. Yeah. Did you talk about this openly to your family at all once the article came out?
I kind of did. I mean, I've always, like, they always ask me about things, like, what, one day, like, I was talking about something very technical, with my father, that it was something he didn't think I should know anything about. And I kind of went into that, and then he's sitting there looking at me, and he's like, what do you do all day? And I was like, oh,
classified, you know, dad. Yeah.
Never mind. It doesn't matter, you know. So I mean, I never really had any conversations with my family. You can't really share this stuff, so
it's hard. Yeah.
You know, I don't, it was not something I ever discussed with them. So it felt very uncomfortable and kind of weird to now be discussing this with them. But I thought, you know, it's out there. I mean, it's out there now. I mean, it must have been declassified somehow.
So does that release you from your obligation to keep information classified when it shows on the news? And how much does it release? Does it only release how much has been already, you know, made public? Are there aspects of this story that you still can't and don't talk about?
There's aspects of a lot of things and are involving this topic in particular that I won't talk about. I mean, but I will tell you that. So just because something is out in the public sphere doesn't release me, right, from discussing it, because if the government wants to deny it, right, then they certainly have the right to do that, because it could have been something that was leaked. Right. And this could pertain to anything classified. Right. It doesn't necessarily have to be about UFOs. And so that doesn't necessarily release me and make me able to talk about it, because I still have that non-disclosure agreement that I signed.
So at the point that they said, yeah, this was video from the Roosevelt, this is real, that's when you can start affirming that you've seen this video before.
Yeah. And that's when I felt comfortable doing it. Because I thought, okay, it's out there in the public sphere anyway. You know, I'll just admit, okay, I was there. You know, I've seen it before. You know, and I didn't really think that was a big deal, because the public knew about it at this point. You know,
I remember being angry when the article was at Glowing Auras and Black Money came out.
Yeah,
I was pissed when I saw that article. Because I've always been a Bob Lazar fan. I know what they did to him. I know what they've done to other people to discredit them, to ruin their lives. Mm-hmm. And when I saw that, I was like, you lying sacks of... Because it's offensive when millions of people globally experience these things, and then we're told that we're crazy, that it's not happening. And the military themselves, the government themselves are experiencing this. It's an insult. As a grown man, I'm 42-year-old. It's an insult to me that reality is different than what we're allowed to accept. You know what I mean? Right. Like, mm-hmm. That's the part. We're able to accept that somebody identifies as a dog and likes to go to the park and act like a dog, but we can't accept that we're possibly being visited by who knows what. Could be a multitude of things. But that's the part that makes me angry, is that we're willing to accept such like folly.
That and, I don't know about.
Dude, in New York, there was a group of people dressed like dogs, and they all met and acted like dogs all day.
Oh, they're like furries or whatever. Is this a sex thing? I don't think
it is. I just think they like to act like dogs and dress like dogs. But gotcha. Okay. We're willing to accept that. Yeah, but we're willing to accept that, but not people saying, hey, I'm having contact with non-humans. And that's the part that I can't grasp my head around. It seems asinine that that's our behavior.
Right. And, you know, I will say that that's one of the reasons that I decided to come forward publicly and to write this book, because I will readily admit that I am one of those people that in my life just kind of dismissed all of this. Right. But I dismissed it because we've always been told there's nothing there. Right.
Right.
And so is that my fault? Really all my fault? Or is that kind of government's fault as well? You know what I mean? Like, so,
yeah.
So I felt like, you know, I felt like I have a moral obligation now to say something, because this happened to me. Right. And I knew it was happening to other people. So this stuff is not a joke.
No,
it's not easy. And I think people post this encounters docuseries that I was in, I feel like maybe they just don't know what to do with this yet. You know, yes, I mean, it's had a lot of views. I think it's still in the top 10, even today.
Great show. They did a good job.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that people are watching it and they're kind of maybe a little bit apprehensive. They aren't sure what to do with this topic, right? And and I think that that's where most of the public is right now. But I also did not feel it was right. You know, that you had, how can you be a government that's like of the people, for the people, and I swore an oath to uphold that, and then yet you're going to lie to them, and you're okay with people who are having these experiences going to a psychiatrist, right? And that psychiatrist may diagnose them with schizophrenia, psychosis, something that, depending on your career, could be career ending.
Which on meds, yeah.
Yeah, and like if you're a pilot and you're diagnosed with schizophrenia, you're never going to fly again. Right.
I've talked to multiple pilots who told me that if they had ever seen anything, there's no way they ever would have reported it to anybody. And that's both military and commercial pilots have told me that personally.
Right. And so for these people to suffer in silence, I think is just ridiculous. And I felt like, you know what? I was only 4 years away from retirement. I would have been retiring in 2024. But I felt like I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do this. This is ridiculous, you know, and I have a moral compass and a moral obligation to say something. Right. So that's why I did what I did.
And that probably also has a lot to do with your experiences that go beyond just the gimbal and the go fast videos. Right. I mean, your experiences became much more personal, right? Would you like to talk about those? Is that part of what makes you want to speak?
Yeah, and that's part of what like kind of makes me like the whole moral compass thing, right? It's just, I feel like this is the UFO phenomenon is much more than people think it is, right? It's not just crafts with beings from some other planet it is not nearly as simple as that. Right. It strikes at the heart of what is reality. And like you said, that affects every living thing on this planet, right? Not just humans. It affects everything. So, you know, I don't know. I felt like I had to write this book, and my experiences did get very personal As I say in Encounters, I had non-human entities in my room at night.
When did that start? And how did it start? Did it have a sort of arc to increase over time and change?
Or, yeah, I mean, this the whole experience, right, had this like story arc to it, which was odd, right? And I write about this in the book, and I compare it to the mythology of Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey, right? That you have this hero that goes on this journey of like discovery, and then he comes back with the treasure into the world. And that's, I think, why these stories have always been told, was because of this experience that I had, and it's always been a part of humanity. And so if you're going to, that's like saying we're going to classify water or air, right? It doesn't exist. Don't talk about it. You know, it's more of like a force of nature. And you can't classify that or claim some kind of ownership over it if it's something that everybody lives and breathes. You know, it's just, you can't do that. So anyway,
so what were the experiences that led you to this conclusion that it's more than just, you know, maybe ETs and spaceships or whatever?
Right. Well, I in the beginning, I didn't know what it was. It was the first non-human that I saw in my room at night that kind of gave me a hint that there is way more going on here than I understood at the time.
You gotta tell us that story.
Okay, so I'm in my bed at night, right, and I'm asleep, and I feel something grab my arm, and I wake up, and I'm in my room, and I'm looking around, and then all of a sudden my room starts to go a little bit blurry. So I went to go raise my hands to my face and like wipe the sleep out of my eyes. And my hand just flopped there, and I realized I can't move, you know? And then I realized, oh, I woke up because somebody is grabbing my arm right now, you know? And so I kind of fought to turn my head to the right, and I see this just like a, I guess what people always describe as like a shadow figure, right? I see a torso, a head, and two arms kind of standing over me. And it's kind of looking at me, right? And so it's leaning in as I'm waking up and looking at it. And all of a sudden, like this light starts to illuminate my room behind this entity. Right. And then it becomes so bright, and then it becomes like these rays of golden light coming out of its head, which is a bizarre thing to see. But, you know, in having this experience the next day, I thought about it and I was like, that looks like religious art that I've seen from all over the world.
Oh, you wow. Know,
like the halo or the light behind the person or the rays of light from the extending from the head. I was like, people have been seeing this forever, you know? And so that was like, you know, this isn't just aliens. There's something more, there's something more substantial here.
So this couldn't have been a dream. This being appears to you and it's just there and then sort of vanishes, or was there an encounter or
communication? So, you know, then like I fall asleep after this light show. I fall back asleep, and then I start to have this sexual dream of an ex of mine and I. And then I'm kind of lucid, like I'm waking back up out of this dream, and I can see that I'm back in my room. You know, I'm still in my room, in fact, and there's this woman on top of me, you know, and she's obviously engaged in a sexual act with me, and my hands are on her thighs, and I can feel her skin, and it does not feel like human skin. It feels much thicker than normal human skin would feel, and kind of a little bit tighter almost than normal human skin would feel.
Was she human looking at all, Matthew?
So I panned up to try to get a look at her face, and her face was blurred. I could not As I moved up, it got blurrier and blurrier, so I could not see her face. She wasn't going to let me see it. And I don't know why. Maybe that I kind of have things that I think about that these days, like, that the face kind of will define someone in space and time and say that this is what I am, you know? And so if you can't see the face, then you can't necessarily put an incorrect label on it, if right. That makes any sense, which is done in religion too, right? Like you can't show the face of Muhammad because or because it's like considered blasphemous, and it's
because we don't know, yeah,
right, because he's more than just that face, right?
Yeah.
And so yeah, so this experience goes on. I'm in and out of sleep, in and out of this dream. And then I wake up the next morning, and that's when everything, I was just like, what happened last night? You know? And I felt sick. I just felt sick to my stomach. I was like, I can't believe this, you know, that happened. And I don't know what that was. You know what I mean? I did kind of know, because at the time I was thinking to myself, there must be some craft parked in the backyard right now, and that's what she came here in, you know. So it was just, so that was the beginning of it for me. If you can imagine that happening to you, right, that is terrifying, that something is just waking you up in your house, in your bed, you know, and it can just do whatever it wants to. But so I was just terrified. They continued to show up. The experiences went on from there.
Were they usually sexual?
No. No, that was the only one that was like that.
Did you feel do you feel violated? I mean, do you feel raped by this experience?
I did initially. I did. I was just like, this is not right, you know.
Especially in your own home, right?
Right. Like, I did. I felt violated. And I also felt just very sick, because it was like, I can't even tell anybody that this happened to me. Because what am I gonna call the police?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
What are the police gonna do? They're gonna get in their spaceship and go figure it out, you know? No, they're gonna put me in a straitjacket and call it a day, you know. And so,
I was gonna say, Matthew, there's a gentleman you should reach out to in Australia. Mary Rodwell investigated his case. I don't know if you've seen the interview or not. Mm-hmm. But he had a very similar case to yours when he was napping in the afternoon. He's 19 years old, and he wakes up and there's a blonde woman on him. He could tell she's not human, because she has a little bit wider set eyes, skin's different, and she's in the middle of doing something to him, and there's another female at the end. And when he started waking up, she brought him to her breast, and he bit her breast, and a bit of flesh in his mouth was almost acidic. And she got up right away, and he could hear her telepathically talk to the other entity there that he's not doing what he's supposed to do. Something's wrong. And I thought that was very interesting, because they left, he found a golden hair, and this sounds weird, around the tip of his penis, and it was embedded in there. He had to take it out with tweezers, and he says one of the most horrific pains he's ever had. And then he went to the hospital and got checked out. But it's one of the, you know, he talks about it. He says it never happened again. But the fact that it happened in the middle of the afternoon while his parents were having a barbecue, and he's upstairs in his room. And this is what people don't understand, that it could be at any point in time. It doesn't have to be in the middle of the night. You could be broad daylight if people get taken. Yeah. So your case, you know, there's somebody else, another male, because we normally hear about females. We never hear about the male, but that's very interesting. Females usually are artificially inseminated, but males seem to be having more physical interactions, if you will, with whatever female of whatever species is there. So that's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I will say that, you know, I do have a much more generative, I think, conceptualization of what all of this means. And I can
tell us about that. What do you think it means?
I mean, that's very complex. I think that the experience that I had kind of forms the basis of all the world's religions, right? And I know that that sounds ridiculous, but you have to understand that there are people who research this, and I'm reading a book right now called The Secret Body by Jeffrey Kripal.
Jeffrey Kripal, yeah. Dr. I was going to suggest Kripal. You check out Jeffrey Kripal. I really want to get him on the show. I think his work's fantastic and obviously has a lot to do with sexuality and spirituality.
Yes.
And the anomalous.
Yeah. And so he kind of also, it's all about a comparative study of religions. And you can just see, I can see the experience I had kind of painting all the world's religions. I see it in all of them. Right. Like the experience I had. So it was like I write it in my book as an initiatory experience. That's why I call it initiated. Right. And so it's an initiation into like higher consciousness, and it can be a very traumatic event. The whole experience can be very traumatic, and it certainly was for me, but it's that way because it has to be. And my theory on this is just that it's a very delicate balance of brain chemistry that has to be achieved. And you do that through kind of correct thinking and kind of your cognitive abilities to be able to put things together and frame them differently in the mind, which then brings together a certain cocktail of the correct brain chemistry, as it were. And so you end up having this thing that just connects in the mind. And I describe this using Jungian psychology, actually, in the book, that it's like you have these archetypes, right, in the mind. And you can think of these archetypes as lines of psychological development. And when you've developed yourself correctly along these lines, they match the lines that are embedded in the subconscious, and you connect with it. And when you make that connection through this correct brain chemistry, and they'll work with you to get you there. And why things are sometimes terrifying, they're sometimes just incredibly intense emotionally. But it's all about achieving that connection, which, you know, would be like an experience of God, right? Like nirvana, enlightenment. Spiritual.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so that's the objective there, is to connect to this higher consciousness that people, you know, in Christianity they kind of call it gnosis. An experience of gnosis. And so that's
sort of hidden knowledge. Gnosis is kind of an obscured knowledge. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely.
There was something too when I was part of the church and I was the guy on the stage singing the songs, leading the church in worship. At the time, I was religious, of course, but there is something there when everybody's together on the same focus, same thought, there is an energy.
Mm-hmm.
The same energy is when, let's say, when you see crowds of people, they're starting to riot in the streets. A lot of people are like, I don't know why I rioted. Everybody was doing it, so I just joined in. There's a crowd mentality that's innate in humans. But I think the spiritual aspect, when we're all together, there is something there. You know, you could feel that it's God, or maybe it's a connectivity to other people around you. So that's really interesting. We're going to cut the interview here, guys. We are going to follow up with Matthew here in a Patreon episode. So we're going to record that right here. So please go to Patreon to visit. We're probably going to do another 10, 15 minutes, if that's okay with you guys. And I would really encourage you guys to go and purchase Matthew Roberts' book. It's called Initiated. I will put the link in the description on all the platforms for you to guys find it. I think it's on Amazon. Is there another location to find this book, Matthew?
No, it's only on Amazon. I had to self-publish because I think everybody thinks that this stuff is
is crazy, know,
not real. So
they don't want to touch it yet, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I got a feeling, though, that even though it's still sort of taboo, the news network are starting to sign exclusives with these whistleblowers. You know, News Nation had David Grosh, but I think the other news network are going to want to rush and try to get an exclusive with somebody as well. Mm-hmm. It's going to become big money in the media once it catches on, of course, right? So again, thank you so much, Matthew, for coming on. We are going to send, if people want to reach out to you, somebody else that has an experience or were part of the service and they had an experience, where can they find you, Michael? Matthew?
Yeah, they can find me on Twitter, UAP Philosophy on Twitter or UFO Philosophy on Twitter. And then I have my email address on my Facebook page. So
perfect. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for being on UAP Studies. Let's have you back. There's a lot developing. And I would love to hear your thoughts on what's going to happen here in the near future.
Yeah,
thanks, Matthew.
Thank you.